Nibbana, the third of the ennobling truths. Over the course of the weekend, as we explore this theme, I'm really hoping, actually, that this word becomes something more than just a word, that we actually do begin to understand what the Buddha spoke about in this third ennobling truth, the unshakable liberation of the heart. But I'm hoping that it becomes a word that actually that becomes part of your inner vocabulary. Something that you feel comfortable with, something that you feel at ease with, and as a word actually that has something to do with you. That has something to do with why you practice, with where your practice is going, the direction of the practice you engage in, to be able to envisage the fruition of that practice, that path that you're on. And actually, I'd almost like to, I have a sort of recycle bin of words that I think we ought to sort of consign there. And practice is one of them. I think it would be far more useful for us to consider being on a path. And this path that the Buddha spoke about, this path of awakening, it has a beginning point, it has a start point, and it also has a destination and a fruition. And the Buddha spoke not so much about people having a practice, but people being on a path of learning to what it means to live an awakened life. What it means to live an awakened life. So as we reflect on this theme of Nibbana, I'm hoping, this would be my dearest hope, that by the end of the weekend you actually have in some ways incorporated this sense of possibility into your own path that you're on. To read you a quote that, or a teaching from the Buddha that many of you will be familiar with, the simile of the raft. Bhikkhus, suppose a person in the course of a journey saw a great expanse of water whose near shore was dangerous and fearful and whose further shore was safe and free from fear. But there was no ferry boat or bridge going to the far shore. Then the person thought, here is this great expanse of water, dangerous on the near shore and fearful, and whose further shore is safe and free from fear, but without a way to cross. Suppose I collect grass, twigs, branches, and leaves, and bind them together into a raft, and supported by the raft, and making an effort with my hands and feet, I got safely across to the far shore. And then the person proceeded to collect the grass, twigs, branches, and leaves, and bound them together into a raft. And supported by the raft, and making an effort with their hands and feet, they got safely across to the far shore. Then when they got across and had arrived at the far shore, they might think thus, this raft has been very helpful to me. Supported by it and making an effort with my hands and feet, I got safely across to the far shore. Suppose I were to hoist it on my head or load it on my shoulder and then go wherever I want. Now, Bhikkhus, what do you think? By doing so, would that person be doing what should be done with the raft? No, venerable sir. Would that person be doing what should be done with the raft? Here, because when the person got across and had arrived at the far shore, they might think thus, this raft has been very helpful to me. Since supported by it and making an effort with my hands and feet, I got safely across to the far shore. Suppose I were to haul it onto the dry land or set it adrift in the water and then go wherever I want. Now, because it is by doing so that that person would be doing what should be done with the raft. So I have shown you how the Dharma is similar to a raft, being for the purpose of crossing over, not for the purpose of grasping. Because when you know the Dharma to be similar to a raft, you should abandon even good states. How much more so bad states? So the Buddha is using this simile, you know, acknowledging that we have a beginning on the path, standing in a place in our lives that actually can feel troubled, can feel fearful, can feel disturbed and confused. And then we look and we hear there's a possibility of another shore, another place, another way of being, another way of abiding that's really free from trouble, free from distress, free from fear. And we look for the ways to actually make that journey. And the ways that many of us have made that journey is through beginning to cultivate a path and a formal cultivation of meditative practice that is the means for going across, the means for crossing this territory. The Buddha very clearly points out that it's not the raft alone. You know, we can really have available to us, you know, some wonderful ways of developing, wonderful ways of practicing, but it also takes that effort with our hands and feet, doesn't it? The raft doesn't sort of go automatically across from the fearful to the shore that is free from fear. It takes our engagement. And then the Buddha speaks very clearly about the possibility, actually, of really arriving on that shore that is free from fear and free from distress. But even then points out, you know, the tendency of the human mind to want to cling, you know, to want to cling, even to the wholesome and the good, as much as the unwholesome and the unhelpful. And that we can cling to the raft, you know, in so many ways. How, you know, the tendency to cling, which is so implicated in the causing of distress, can be transferred even to the most wholesome places in our life, you know, our practice, our pathway, our role as a meditator, our identity as a meditator. Even here too, there is the danger of sort of establishing a self, establishing a me. So the Buddha is very much pointing out to sort of skillful means, the skillful means we carefully examine for how we might make that same journey from fear and distress to a place of fearlessness and freedom. And he pointed to so many ways that we might do this in the discourses. The Buddha never provided just one map of awakening. Provided many, many maps of awakening through confidence, through metta, through investigation. And what I want to explore this weekend is one particular map, a sort of a kind of a developmental map of awakening through understanding that you find in the early texts repeated over and over again. I want us to feel comfortable about discussing the third ennobling truth, the teaching on liberation, the teaching on unbinding, the teaching on the unshakable freedom of the heart. And I realize this is not always a territory that's part of our sort of common discourse. You know, well, maybe it isn't for you, but I find that for most people it's not so much part of the territory of their you know, most frequently visited dialogues. So I want to just sort of give you some feedback that I've received, you know, in raising the topic, the possibility of nirvana. When in teachings, you know, it would be, you know, if I ask the question, and sometimes I have asked this question in the past, how many of you here really practice for the third ennobling truth? How many of you here actually feel that your path and your practice is in the service of actually discovering exactly the same liberating insights and the unshakable freedom that the Buddha actually discovered? I think it's really important to acknowledge that the Buddha always sought for graduates. He didn't seek for perpetual followers or students. The entire encouragement in his teaching was for people to actually really come to exactly the same liberating insights that he himself had come to. If we ask the question here, and I don't think I will, but maybe it would be an interesting exercise. But if I ask the question here, you know, how many of you really feel that possibility to be true for yourself, that the understanding of liberation is really central in your own path? How many of you would actually feel that to be so? I won't ask the question. When I've asked that question in the past, I've really received some very curious and interesting and very valid responses. For some, there's a feeling, you know, like there isn't the other shore. You know, that's kind of just a dream, or, you know, an illusion, or even if there is, that other shore is not possible for me. I've had the response from some people, and, you know, certainly this was true in the early years of my own practice, you know, where it was kind of like Nibbanic warriors, you know, people kind of quite happy to die on the cushion in the service of awakening, you know, and where really that was the only thing that mattered, that sometimes actually really wasn't always helpful if it meant that sort of you know, ethics and relatedness and compassion were somehow placed in second place. Some people have told me they're not really interested in liberation. You know, like just a little more calm would be good. You know, or a little bit more peacefulness, or, you know, just a little bit more sanity in their life would be, you know, just kind of good enough. And some people have told me, well, I used to practice to be awakened. You know, in the years when I was doing loads of intensive retreats before life caught up with me, and, you know, I had jobs and families and responsibilities. And now I don't really think about it as being possible for me, that it somehow it requires a certain kind of set of conditions to be present in life, you know, to be a monastic, or, you know, to live a cloistered life. Some people have said to me, I'm too imperfect. You know, I've got too much to work on. I have too many issues, you know, that get in the way, that I need to work on and to work out and to understand. Some people have talked to me about the troubled relationship that they have with goals. You know, that the sense of having a goal seems to immediately invite sort of really difficult levels of striving and forcing and almost aversion for what is. And, you know, goals are so culturally stressed and actually are really difficult for many people, that some people feel like, I don't really want to go there, because I don't really want to go into those cycles again of ambition and striving and the frustration and the lack of self-worth when my goals are disappointed. None of these responses are terrible in any way. I think they're part of the terrain of exploring for ourselves what is our own relationship to the third ennobling truth, because we can't actually get away from it. You know? It's actually what makes sense of the other three ennobling truths, that there is the possibility of awakening and an unshakable liberation of the heart. So I think it's helpful for us to actually explore and to question what our own relationship to that possibility actually is. It's, if you read the early texts, you really do get such a clear sense of what an aspirational path this is. That the Buddha really held out the possibility of realizing the deepest and most profound emotional and psychological freedom in our lives. The freedom from the patterns and the habits that so lead to confusion and alienation and disconnection. The Buddha's path was deeply aspirational. He so recognized that the seeds of very profound, very liberating understanding, compassion, really lie in every human heart. He did not reserve the teachings of awakening for a spiritual elite in his time. This would be the first discourse often that he would give an offer to new students, was on the possibility of awakening. He also actually saw, you know, it was really related to our capacity to have confidence in that. You know, you have to remember the Buddha just wasn't teaching a fan club, you know. He was teaching, you know, serial killers and, you know, people with murderous intents and, you know, people with just a great deal of confusion. And his teaching was always clear in saying that if I did not have the confidence that it was possible for you to awaken, I would not ask it of you. But because I know that this is possible for you, therefore I ask this of you. To travel this path with all its challenges, all its ups and downs and peaks and valleys, to travel this path and actually come to the understandings that really liberate. I think it's very important in the beginning of this discussion to recognize that Pali, the language of the early texts, was very much a language of verbs and process. It's not a language of nouns, states, or definitions. Everything is formed and communicated in terms of process. So the Buddha didn't actually speak of suffering as being some fixed or some predetermined state. In fact, the word suffering is actually really not a good word. I think in exploring this, because this is where we begin, most of us. I mean, I have met people who come into this path from a place of great joy, you know, and great sort of inspiration. And I have met many more people who come into this pathway as a way of, you know, seeking to understand the confusions that beset them. Seeking to understand this word dukkha. And, you know, I'm going to ask you, many of you will be so familiar with this word, dukkha. And to translate it as suffering is really inadequate, actually, and not helpful. And I will go much more into this later on in the day. But dukkha actually translates as a messy space. You know, I think about dukkha as just being in a bad space. You're just in a messy space. It's not always this excruciating anguish and torment, although there's quite enough of that in this life, you know. It's not always these states, places of great tragedy or loss. It's the normal, everyday, just background hum of being in a messy space, you know, both externally and internally. You know, earlier in the year I was teaching at IMS, and when I packed one croc from one pair of crocs and another croc from another pair of crocs. One was new and one was old. And the whole time at IMS I was in this slight sort of limp, you know, the entire time I was there. And I thought, this is dukkha, you know. It's just a messy space, you know. It's nothing excruciating, you know, I'm not going to die of this. It's just a kind of, this sort of background sort of unease that things are not quite right. So the Buddha very much speaks of dukkha as something that is born and created and recreated and reborn moment to moment. There's nothing predetermined about it. There is nothing fixed about it. It is because it is fluid and created and recreated that there is the potential to transform that messy space. That is what is actually so important to understand. If it was not a process, if there was something fixed, if there was something predetermined about this, it would not be subject to change. And when the Buddha offered his teaching, you know, it was so simple that I teach dukkha and the end of dukkha, and that dukkha is to be understood. It's not what we usually do with dukkha, you know. We usually flail against it, you know, and strategize around it and look for ways to fix it or looks to get ways to get rid of it, always looking for the good space, you know, the good space that feels very far away. The Buddha's verse said very clearly, dukkha is to be understood, this process of confusion and distress be created and recreated. This is the process we can understand. And when we understand that and the origins that keep compelling the mind to keep creating and recreating distress, when the origins of that compulsion are understood, then dukkha can come to an end. And this is nibbana. This is the third ennobling truth. Described not only dukkha being a process, but as awakening as also being a process. And I'm sure, you know, all of you actually know that. You know, those little changes inwardly where suddenly we feel actually we can stop feeding a habit pattern that creates distress. You know, those little shifts of view inwardly where suddenly we're actually able to see something anew. You know, those little changes, understandings inwardly that we embody and enact in our life, actually where we see actually things fall away. And we find ourselves, you know, living our lives slightly differently. Not necessarily huge, big change, but radical changes inwardly. Where suddenly we might see, suddenly, you know, we're less impatient. We're less judgmental. We're less aversive or we're less obsessive. We see those changes falling away, and that is actually a process of waking up, okay? It's a process of waking up. So I think what I'm trying to really stress here is don't make this process of awakening so romantic, so remote, so distant, as if it's not a process you are already engaged in. So I don't, you know, the Buddha speaks very much about liberating. Another word, please, for the recycle bin is enlightenment. This is a, you know, much more recently introduced Western term, you know, describing, you know, social changes and, you know, cultural changes. I think awakening is something different. Enlightenment is this, I don't think it's a helpful word, you know, it's too charged. But awakening and unshakable awakening. This is also, you know, the unshakable awakening is not separate from the process of awakening. So this is actually what we are actually engaged with. And I think what I would really like to encourage you or encourage over this weekend is to really think of yourself as being students of nibbana. Students of awakening. And actually, would that make any difference in how you formulate your own path or formulate your own practice that actually does have a sense of direction, which is something far more profound than only becoming calmer or, you know, a little bit more peaceful? That is actually the third ennobling truth. And hopefully, over what we, you know, what I want to, as I mentioned, what I want to present this weekend is one of the maps that the Buddha presented. It's a map of awakening, a map of how things fall away and what comes into being. Because I'm sure you've seen in your own life that as some of the difficulties that we have, you know, in the past got really entangled with, you know, like frustration or expectation or judgment, as they start to lessen and fall away, they don't leave a vacuum behind them, do they? You know, it's often they leave, it's often the emergence, you know, of a greater sense of kindness, a greater sense of generosity, a greater sense of patience. There is a real question here I would put out. We often assume that when it is the falling away of things that allows the wholesome and the liberating to come into being, which I think is not so supported in the early texts. I think what is much more supported is it is through the actual cultivation and the practice of the liberating and the wholesome that actually the difficult and the confusing falls away. But what we do see is that there is a never a vacuum. There is a never a vacuum. The falling away of the cultivation of metta means the falling away of aversion. The falling away of greed allows for the embodiment of generosity. There is never a vacuum. So I think what I'd like to suggest, because we have been sitting for an hour and a half, I'd like to suggest that we take a half an hour walking period, and maybe you, in the service of cultivating our capacity for reflective thinking, I'd like you just to invite you, if it works for you, to take into that walking period just a little bit of an open question to reflect on about what is your own relationship to the third ennobling truth? What is your own sense of relatedness to the possibility of unshakable awakening as really being the heart of all that you do and have done and will do in this path and this practice? Just to hold that as a kind of a background question and listen inwardly as you walk, just to sense what arises, it's not a right answer to this, isn't it? This is an open question, you know, it's an inquiry.